Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on the Mushroom Hour podcast, we are honored to be joined by Jeff Williams, PhD, International Sentinel Network Coordinator for the U.S. Forest Service. Jeff studies the social dimensions and microbial ecology of host range expansions and geographic range expansions of forest trees, their fungal pathogens, and their insect herbivores. Jeff just moved to Oregon from West Lafayette, Indiana, where he studied the role of the microbiome in thousand cankers disease of eastern black walnut in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources at Purdue University. Prior to that, he has worked and lived in Idaho, Arizona, Mexico, and Chicago, originally hailing from Ann Arbor, Michigan. In his current position, he is gathering information on forest insects and pathogens across the world. The ultimate goal is to build networks of cooperation and information exchange with international collaborators to help protect native forest tree species in the U.S. and all over the world from the next highly destructive or devastating insect or fungal pathogen that could be introduced through trade and travel. It's important to note that the opinions expressed by Jeff in our show today do not represent policy stances of the U.S. government. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's really exciting. I love your podcast.
Right on. Well, I know you had some experience in the podcast world yourself, so I really appreciate that feedback. And the topics you wanted to talk about, I think, are extremely important and, frankly, things that many of us may know are occurring but don't want to think about because we feel powerless to stop them. So it's really a privilege to be able to speak with someone about such wide-ranging issues about the forests we all know and love. But before we dive in, what is the story of Jeff Williams, PhD? You know, how did you get on this path of protecting forests, studying science, getting where you are today?
I guess it was a pretty winding path, but I came to study nature kind of later on. My mom always had a vegetable garden and my parents took me camping and backpacking, and I always loved that. And I always liked learning about science, but I didn't really realize after I had taken some time off actually in college and went back to school to study plant biology, I had a really good experience at the University of Michigan Biological Station, which is up in northern Michigan. It's almost like summer camp for ecology and evolutionary biology students. And we went morel hunting. It was the first time hunting mushrooms. And I took this class with a guy named Scott Heron, an ethnobotany class there. It was really transformative for me. It was my first introduction to botany and then the human kind of component of botany at the same time. And after that, I became more and more interested in plants and eventually fungi too.
That's amazing. So introduced to fungi through morels, you know, not an unheard of story. That's a great place to get familiar with the world of mushrooms. And I guess in your research, you know, what first turned you on to this concept of fungal phytopathogens? I mean, was it just you dove into researching it? Was it a project that came your way where someone needed help in their lab studying this? How did that relationship start?
That's really, yeah, that was also kind of a circuitous path because I really got hooked on fungi for the first time by taking mycology with Tim James at University of Michigan. And I highly recommend you have him on the show sometime because he's awesome.
I'm taking notes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I went morel hunting, but then I took some time off from school. I didn't think I wanted to go to grad school. And then I went down to Panama, actually, to help someone I had met in college, a grad student who was finishing his fieldwork. And there I met another grad student who was working on endophytes. So I got really, really psyched about endophytes. I wanted to go back to school, go to grad school, and study endophytes in forests. And that's how I came to start studying forest pathology originally at University of Idaho, because a lot of the ideas and techniques and everything that goes into studying pathogens really applies itself quite a bit to study of fungal endophytes as well, because they both live inside of plants. They tend to be from the same groups of fungi, mostly Escomycota. And a lot of the questions we were asking were kind of the roles of of endophytes in the microbiome in modulating the severity of disease, protecting plants, or even like ganging up on plants with pathogens or transitioning to becoming pathogens. So I started with this interest in endophytes. That's how I kind of got into forest pathology. And actually, my interest in forestry was the most recent. So, but in the process, I became really interested in the science of forestry as well.
I mean, a fascinating path with all these interconnected disciplines, especially what you just said about endophytes. You know, I've often thought that, where is the line between endophyte and pathogen? What are they doing in there? So you can see that chain of questioning and interest in your path. And, you know, something I really like to do, I feel like, on the show is get into some fundamentals and make sure that the listeners and myself kind of have the right framework to deal with when we talk about some of these issues. So when we talk about a healthy forest, a forest ecosystem, forest pathology, you know, this is a topic that could span multiple podcasts, and really it does. But what are some of the factors that play into a healthy forest ecosystem? And then maybe to kind of specify what keeps, because we know that fungi like endophytes and pathogens are kind of omnipresent. They're in plant life all over the place. So what helps regulate that relationship to make sure that plant and fungus are healthy? So, you know, massive topic I just put in front of you, but know, some of the basics of healthy forest pathology or healthy forest ecosystems, and then what kind of keeps things in balance between plant and fungal populations.
I'm so glad that you asked that question, because it's really something that people don't always stop to think about in science. It's actually a question of ethics, in my opinion, because when we start using the word healthy, that's like a normative statement, and we start to talk about, it's almost like a, like in Western medicine, you think of if you're sick, then you need medicine, or you could be healthy. But in forests, this idea of a healthy tree doesn't always work, because in forests, disturbance plays an extremely important role in regulating diversity and maintaining just both species diversity, like at local scales, and landscape diversity at really huge, even continental scales. And so, you know, pests and pathogens are, they're insects, herbivores, root rots, foliar pathogens, canker pathogens. They all play a role in ecosystems to kind of generate this disturbance, allow like new growth, new resurgence, so that every kind of parcel in the land is sort of in a different stage of succession or different structure. And even at local scales, it allows plants to grow together that are like unrelated.
Hmm.
So when we talk about healthy forests, there's a lot of really good things that come from pests and pathogens. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, because when we talk about invasive species, it helps us kind of remind ourselves that we're always talking about our relationship with the ecosystem when we're talking about these things. So we want our forests to be productive. We want them to provide a certain type of service, whether that's economic or ecological. And anytime we're talking about healthy forests or invasive species, we're really talking about management goals for our forests.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, and I appreciate you breaking down that framework, and it makes so much sense, you know, that pathogens have an important role, and a healthy forest ecosystem involves all cycles, including death and organisms getting taken over. And, you know, so in that context, you know, how do we define a healthy forest, quote unquote, right? Or how do we, is it some measure of, like you said, some kind of economic measure? How do you quantify something like ecosystem services? And you could tell when that's kind of getting out of balance, you know, what are some of those metrics? How do we measure them? And how do we know when it's a quote unquote problem? Because now you've kind of made things a little murkier for me in that, you know, just because pathogens are taking out a species of tree, is that universally a bad thing? So how do we kind of set our framework in establishing, you know, what an ecosystem should look like? You know, what are some of those measures and how do we figure that out?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's a really difficult question. but I mean, some of the things that we can do is we can attempt to quantify ecosystem services. It's not perfect because there's also intrinsic value in forests.
Right.
So some of the value that comes from forests could just be in cultural values, our heritage, like the redwoods. I mean, yes, they fix a lot of carbon, but ultimately we just don't want to see these redwoods die because they're so big and they're so old and they're so magnificent.
Right.
Well, on the other hand, you know, you might have Monterey cypress. It's planted throughout the world, but its native population is really just one little tiny part of the California coast. We want to protect those populations. Same thing with radiata pine. Or you have something like Douglas fir. I mean, Douglas fir is like from Mexico to Canada,
right,
all the way from, you know, throughout the West, inland, West, and coastal. And so just giant species distribution, many, many populations, lots of diversity. But, you know, if something came in, because there's not really a lot of close relatives to Douglas fir, like in the world. But if there was something that came in that could like wipe out Douglas fir, that would be just devastating.
Right.
So, I mean, there's so many different ways that we can value an ecosystem or an ecological association, like a specific species. And a lot of times in science, we focus a lot on carbon, especially in forestry. So there was recently some studies that were looking at the effect of invasive pathogens on forest productivity, carbon, the carbon cycle, or the number of, you know, the amount, the actual volume of carbon that's being lost,
right,
lost or released, or the decrease in productivity, meaning the decrease in the amount that's being fixed that could be attributed to these invasions.
Mm.
But you could also look at things like water quality, specific services that different species provide. For example, with the American chestnut, which is now functionally extinct, but used to be a dominant species throughout the eastern U.S., it was a really important source of not just timber, but more importantly, it was a source of food for animals, birds, as well as squirrels and things like that. And that they now rely much more heavily on oaks and other species for that. But also farmers in the, you know, eastern United States, they could count on a good crop if they had forest property of chestnuts that provided food and economic benefits every year. And that was removed from Appalachia due to this disease. And some people argue that it actually had a lasting economic impact on the region.
Incredible. Incredible. And actually, the first thing you said about diversity really stuck out because I kind of pushed us out into really gray area when I was like, well, how do we know if it's good or bad and what an ecosystem should look like? And so, yeah, you talked about those objective kind of human measures, some of the scientific ecosystem services measures, especially when it comes to, you know, carbon metrics, water quality. But even at the most fundamental level is that idea of diversity. So you know something's a problem when you start to lose an entire species, diversity in the ecosystem starts going down because you're losing species. That's something that we feel compelled to address. That's something we feel like needs to be studied, understood, and addressed really at its most fundamental level. So I really, really appreciated that. And when we're talking about invasives, I guess to go back in a little gray area, species organismal flow has been happening since the beginning of time. Organisms move from place to place. So how are we nowadays categorizing a quote unquote invasive? And has there been kind of an era where this idea of organismal flow has become kind of a problem that we're worried about instead of the natural course of things? And why?
Oh man, yeah, that's an excellent question. So why if things are expanding their ranges, right? If pests are moving around at a certain time scale anyway, and there's a place where they're going to do really well, then I guess it's just a matter of time before they make it there. And then there's going to be some sort of response in evolutionary time to that, whether it's a whole new ecosystem or the species eventually experiences a resurgence and resistance to that, or they come into homeostasis eventually.
Right, right.
But then again, I would take it back to like the fact that humans and forests and ecosystems are all, we're all part of one system. And so we're, on the one hand, you know, we've always been responsible for moving things around. I mean, we've introduced, that's why we call it the Anthropocene. I mean, part of the reason it's the Anthropocene is we've really shaped these landscapes to a point where they're just not what they would be without people. But essentially, the answer to your question is, I think it starts with host resistance and susceptibility. Mm. It's like most pathogens and insects, to a lesser extent, that you'll find in native forests have been around in some form for tens or hundreds of thousands or even millions of years in the ecosystem. Some of them spread here through like adaptive radiation. Others have kind of co-evolved alongside their hosts. You know, for example, mountain pine beetle or armillaria species that cause root rot in oaks or in conifers in the Northwest, they play an important role, like I told you, like we were discussing as disturbance agents. And they've been interacting, the insects and the pathogens and the trees have all been interacting with each other in those ecosystems, you know, over thousands and thousands of years. So there's kind of like a deep memory of that interaction encoded into the genomes of the forest trees and of the insects and of the pathogens. Hmm. They have this memory because they've been in constant contact through all of this time. And so there's all kinds of kind of like an evolutionary homeostasis of genes and genomes that's kind of maintaining a balance. But when we start moving things around, either through rare random dispersal events or aided by human activity, the result is you have these novel associations. So you have a novel host-pest association or host-insect association, which, you know, if you have a lot of them happening over the course of just a couple hundred years, they're happening much, much more frequently than they would normally be, then it's going to really cause massive disturbances. And these disturbances, they're very different from the ones that are caused by native pests and pathogens, the ones that have been here for a long time, because they can completely remove a species of tree, or they can have kind of chronic effects, long-lasting kind of permanent effects. And just to highlight this idea, I think a really good example is if you look at Northern Ohio. So in Northern Ohio, a lot of the forests are dominated by maple beech.
Okay.
Part of the reason for that is because there's just not as much human pressure on forests as there were 300 or 400 years ago, when there was enough human activity that you had a lot more oak in the landscape, because oaks are more of like an early successional or like light demanding species. And so due to management, it's maple, beech, maybe hemlock, right? Well, you got hemlock, you got the hemlock woolly adelgid. That's killing the hemlock. Beech leaf disease is now killing beeches, which are already being killed by beech bark disease. Beech leaf disease is caused by a nematode. Actually, they don't even really know it's causing it yet.
Oh, God.
It appears to be caused by a nematode. And then, of course, that just would leave the maples.
Right.
So, I mean, at a certain point, if you have enough of these kind of things moving around and having all these novel kind of pandemics, like if you have that happening with all your forest species, then that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I
asked, for people.
Exactly. Well, and I asked this big question about, you know, what is an invasive and how can we define that when things move around? And I really like how you define that in novel interactions and the fact that human movement, of course, which has increased exponentially, has created more and more novel interactions in ecosystems, more so than maybe birds flying to a new island or a new ecosystem may have right. in the past of Earth's history. So it is specifically an issue of the Anthropocene, where we're having more of these novel interactions between hosts and new pathogens. And that, as we become more aware of it, we realize the scope of the impact that's having, where, yeah, it might make your three-dimensional forest down into a one-dimensional forest, one species of tree, And, you know, that becomes an issue. We innately know that's an issue from that loss of diversity, but then you have that loss of ecosystem services. And I'm sure in terms of the overall forest health, even how those trees are helping each other to grow and thrive exactly. starts getting thrown off. And now, just to ground it in a specific example, I know that you've researched fungal and fungal phytopathogens and interactions with their hosts. You know, what's it an example system that you can break down where you've seen these novel interactions between a new pathogen, a tree host, and what that's done?
So my PhD dissertation was written on thousand cankers disease. I don't know why I said it like that. Because
it adds a little bit of weight. When we know it's a PhD thesis, it adds some weight there.
Yeah, but I just want to make sure your audience knows that I don't necessarily think that that's that big of a deal. It's just what I chose to spend the last 5 years of my life doing. And there's a lot of other things that are like equally awesome. So,
right.
And that's one of the things I like about the mycological community is that there's so much just like expertise, and it doesn't have to have anything to do with an institution. It's just people that know their surroundings. So yeah, thousand cankers disease of black walnut. It's a really interesting case because, well, so first talk about black walnut. So black walnut is like a subgeneric group of walnuts. There's like 15 or 20 species and at least five in North America, meaning US and Canada. Many more in the neotropics, which the neotropics meaning like Mexico, Central and South America, and the Caribbean. They produce delicious, highly nutritious nuts, and wildlife just love those nuts. We love them. I mean, you can even get, you know, black walnuts different from, you know, the Persian walnut that's grown in California frequently, also known as English walnut.
Right, different than the walnut I get in stores, yeah.
Yeah, probably. But you can, there are producers that actually harvest and sell Eastern black walnut fruit, nuts, and processed like products. It's like the flavor is much more like earthy. And of course, the Native Americans were eating these nuts as a really important component of their diet. I think in Michigan, I learned that they actually would make like a milk kind of drink from like the powder of the nuts.
That's amazing.
It's super healthy, but yeah, I could go on about that. But black walnut also is our most prized native hardwood. So Midwest grown Eastern black walnut is like top choice veneer, which is the like the thin cut that people put on surfaces of of wood if it's not like solid wood. For those of you that don't know veneer, and especially like forest grown black walnut, because those are where you get these big straight trunks that are grown in these closed canopies. So a lot of people try to grow them in plantations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the best veneer comes from old, like closed forest, like exactly where you would be like, oh, really sad to see one of these trees cut down.
Of course, yeah.
The other thing that's interesting about Eastern black walnut is that it's a relative newcomer to North America. I mean, you're talking Pleistocene, so probably a million years or maybe even much more recently than that. And it shows up in pollen records recently. And it probably kind of radiated into Eastern North America as the climate was warming a little bit. And it's a really resource demanding species. So it grows like with lots of light, really rich, nutrient rich soil that's also well drained, but also has adequate moisture. So we call it like a prima donna of hardwoods because it's just this, it does really well in those environments, very competitive. And it was brought out west by pioneers and probably also before that by indigenous people, where it's also hybridized with other species of black walnut that are native to the west coast, like Heinz walnut, California black walnut. There's also a species that goes down into Mexico from Arizona and New Mexico. It's another species out in Texas too. So anyway, that's black walnut. It's grown like throughout the Western US, especially in like urban areas, because it does really well out west. Until around like the late 90s, people started noticing disease and decline in black walnut, especially in like Oregon and Washington, Colorado, on the west coast of California. And then they, you know, some researchers from Colorado State, Ned Tisrat, Whitney Cranshaw, and their students, they discovered kind of this new fungus that's associated with, it's a new species to science that's associated with a bark beetle. Basically, when the bark beetles go into the bark, to the phloem to do their thing, to mate and reproduce, and then the larvae develop under the bark. And these little tiny galleries, really, really just tiny, tiny beetles, less than a millimeter, the fungus infects the phloem, and it just makes kind of like a small area of dead tissue around the gallery. It doesn't like infect the rest of the tree, you know, cause like a systemic infection.
But it's localized where the beetles are.
Yeah. Yeah. But the beetles, they just do like so well out west on black walnut, at this novel association, that they just reproduce like crazy. And then pretty soon, this fungus just takes over the whole cambium in a granula branch. Then you'll start to see, outwardly, you can see trees with like dying leaves, yellowing leaves the first year. And then the second year, maybe most of the crown is dying back. And then, you know, out west, it was originally described as, this disease kills trees in 3 years. That's what they would say.
Hmm.
So, of course, everyone was super worried about eastern black walnut in the eastern U.S. And sure enough, within a year of that first kind of description of this fungus and this disease started popping up in the east, but it hasn't really ended up being a problem in the east. So it's like widespread in terms of multiple states, lots of detections, even like isolated outbreaks where trees were dying and things like that. But it's not like a pandemic like it was out west.
Yeah.
And this is where you have actual like forests where there's substantial amount of black walnut. I mean, there are no like pure black walnut forests, but like
right. There's
a lot more walnut in the landscape. So you would think this disease would be able to spread more easily. But I mean, part of that could be that, you know, there were quarantines and action taken to kind of try to slow its spread. But we were also kind of interested if there were other factors. And so one of the things that I found was that the fungi that live inside of branches of walnut trees, they compete with Geosmithia morbida in wood when it's like drying and dying. And in the east or in the west, the humidity is very low. And so the wood is drier, and the fungus, the pathogen, it does much better competing with these other fungi. But if you look at conditions in the east and the kind of wood moisture content that you would expect in the east, these other fungi that are in walnut wood, they very quickly will outcompete this pathogen. And I was actually able to do a few experiments and then model, based on my results, model like the range where you would expect Geosmithia morbida to win, and it exactly matches the range of this disease.
So that's amazing.
Pretty
wow.
strong evidence that that's a pretty important kind of component. But yeah, there's also, we did some studies to look at, and this is collaborating with a number of people at University of Tennessee, that we looked at, I'll just say their names, like Aaron Onifrock, Janita Hadzabdich, Bill Klingman, and a number of other people. And my professor also at Purdue, Matt Gensel. We're looking at the microbiome of black walnut, the same genotypes of black walnut that were growing in Washington, Tennessee, and Indiana. And then we can look to see, because basically you can take like a gram of plant tissue or soil, and you can see all the thousands of species of fungi or bacteria that are living in that. And then kind of based on what species you see, we kind of know some things about some of these species, like if they're potential pathogens or mycoparasites that could protect the tree from a pathogen, things like that. And we found there was huge differences, not just in the species that were in walnut trees and in the soil around walnut trees, between the Eastern and Western U.S., but also different functional groups in terms of whether their role might be as beneficial or detrimental to the host. And also differences in the amount of diversity, much lower diversity in a lot of cases in the West, like outside of the native range of black walnut, where this disease is a problem. That was just some of the work that we did, but the major takeaway is that black walnut in the Eastern U.S. appears to be much more resilient to this disease, and actually
right.
other researchers have found that some of these trees can actually like get better. They get sick and then they get better. So we're trying to kind of figure out why that might be.
Well, and that example highlights so many big parts of this entire conversation, right? Like that host resiliency right. piece, even just the idea that host resiliency may be affected by factors like other organisms that they're hosting. The diversity yeah. of their compatriot kind of tree species in the forest, you know, the environmental factors,
exactly.
climate factors. Yeah. So that's amazing. So when I think of host resistance, when we first kind of lay that topic out, I'm thinking, okay, what is the tree doing to defend itself against pathogens? But it's actually a much more complex conversation than that when figuring out what makes something more resilient. And the other part of that that I loved is how much we can learn and how much we can predict by studying and understanding the pathogen itself and the model system we're talking about. You know, your research and understanding the other, and I don't want to get this wrong, is it Geometria?
It's Geosmithia.
Geosmithia. Okay, Geosmithia was the one that it competes against, right?
Yeah, Geosmithia morbida is
Geosmithia
the
morbida. Okay, perfect. Is the pathogen. So what is the one that it's competing against?
So any number of different fungi, I mean,
okay.
we found the ones that we commonly would find out competing Geosmithia morbida included like Trichoderma, you know, a couple different species, which has also been employed as biological control in other systems.
Oh, wow.
Another one, Clonostachys rosea, which is like it's actually in the same family as Geosmithia morbida. It's a mycoparasitic fungus. Basically, a lot of fungi, right? Because when we would incubate these pieces of wood, whatever fungi were in them would grow out, right?
Right.
So if we took a piece of wood that was already infected with Geosmithia morbida and incubated it in a moist condition, all these other fungi would outcompete it. But if you incubate it in like a dry condition, Geosmithia morbida would take over everything.
And see, by understanding Geosmithia morbida, understanding the competition it has with other fungi, you learn so much more about the potential introduction pathways that are possible, what areas are under threat. So,
exactly.
you know, when we talk about this big problem, and I think we've kind of broken down in what we're talking about with invasive pathogens, novel interactions, how that has a detriment to diversity, ecosystem services, human economic relevance. But then my mind goes immediately to strategies. What do we do about it? And so research and understanding is a huge
yep.
part of what do we do about it. So, you know, I guess your example gets to a lot of amazing strategies. And before we go all the way there, you know, you've given us one model system where these novel interactions are creating an issue. So, I mean, what is the scope of this? When we talk worldwide, when we talk about a more connected world, humans moving more than ever, what's kind of the broad scope of ecosystems threatened by this kind of novel interaction, specifically when we talk about trees and their phytopathogenic fungi? If you know kind of how broad a problem we're looking at.
I mean, it's extremely broad, but it's also, I mean, it's a fundamental problem because society is moving towards this idea of solving our problems by planting trees, essentially. People
right.
are saying, well, if we just plant more trees, or we protect the forests, more importantly, we protect the forests that are still there. But if we just plant more trees, then this whole problem is going to go away.
We plant more trees, everything's okay. I have fallen
yeah.
into that category before, sure.
And so what does that entail? I mean, first it entails like, well, we have to manage the forests that we already have. And the way that we typically manage disease problems, including invasive disease problems, is we like try as hard as we can to like detect them as soon as possible. But usually, even if we're doing a really good job, by the time they show their face, they've been there.
Right.
They got a
right.
foothold, they established, and now they're like spreading.
Once you know, it's too late.
It's almost too late. So we need to take like a proactive approach to this. And basically, if we want to protect the forest that we already have within this matrix of the Anthropocene, where we have all this different land use changes, climate change, increasing human pressure on ecosystems to provide the services and resources that we need from them to survive. And this really is important all over the world, because people rely directly on these resources throughout the majority of the world. You know, how are we going to protect those forests if we're just moving things around even more, trying to feed an even larger population and have global trade to support the modern way of life, I guess, that we live in this world today? Forests cover like a third of the land area of the world, and they're responsible for, they're one of the biggest contributors to carbon fixation. There's a lot of carbon locked up in forests. And if we want to like lean on that, I guess,
right,
whether it is for carbon or for fiber, for food, foraging. I mean, I'll just give one example. You're familiar with the Mushroom at the End of the World?
Yes, a great book.
Great book. And in this book, I learned that, and this is such an interesting story, I learned that among some social factors and changes that were going around at the time, the introduction of the pine wilt nematode to Japan kind of earlier in the 20th century really did a number on the matsutake harvest. And so that's one of the reasons why you have this global supply chain that brings matsutake from the Western United States to Asia. And so like thinking about how everything is so interconnected, there are many social dimensions of the impacts that these pathogens can have. And we very seldom talk about the social impacts. And those social impacts, they feed back on the ecosystem as well, because we're all connected.
We're nibbling around the edges, and I ask about the scope of this problem. You sent me something very clear before the interview, which is, you know, a global forest health crisis. So what does that look like right now? As best you can, give us that picture of what is the global forest health crisis that we're facing that you see? And then we could talk about strategies, things you see that we can employ to address it.
Great, yeah. So, I mean, the forest health crisis goes so much far beyond forest health per se, like what we're talking about with pests and pathogens.
Mm.
But like all these problems are connected. So, I mean, you have these massive droughts. You have these forest fires, land use change. And then on top of that, you throw on top of that a disease that can come in and just wipe out an entire species of tree, which, you know, a lot of these diseases, and especially the insects, are, you know, becoming emergent problems as a result of these rapidly changing kind of climatic conditions on top of that. So, you know, it's all interconnected.
So there's a lot of problems facing. We've been talking about kind of this fungal pathogen angle, but really fungal pathogens are one smaller subset of the pathogens issue, because you just talked about insects, different things that are coming in, having these novel interactions. But
yeah,
there's a much bigger picture of why there's a forest health crisis.
I think it's important to acknowledge that kind of interconnectedness, because one of the things that we kind of toyed around with is, there's something called, like, this is a very academic, but it's called a wicked problem.
Wicked problem.
A wicked problem. It's like, I don't know, they have this whole set of, I know some of them off the top of my head, but like criteria that make the problem wicked.
Mm.
But one of them is that you change one thing, it creates a whole nother problem. Or, you know, there's no like stopping rule. Like the problem is never solved. It's just, you can make incremental improvements, hopefully, to the problem. But what the really wicked thing about this problem is that there's all these huge conflicts of interest and dilemmas in how we approach it because of the way that we regulate trade on an international level. And, you know, there are policies and agreements in place to protect natural resources and agricultural resources. There's a lot more in place to protect agricultural resources than there are to protect natural resources. But there's also, you know, those agreements basically are there to ensure that I can't use protection of my natural resources from a pathogen or a pest as a pretext for protecting my economy as an export, as a potential import market of another country. So if I say, oh, well, we can't import any more of this item because there might be a pest in it that we don't want to come here, the rules make it...
That's a tricky balance.
Very difficult to... You have to have like very, very strong evidence and specific information of what the risk would be in order to actually impose some sort of regulation to decrease that risk, because no one wants people to just be able to close their borders whenever they want just to like help their local economy.
Right. So it would be fair maybe to say that a lot of the, and this is a gross oversimplification, but a lot of the international trade agreements err more on the side of keeping markets open, international markets open, versus protection of natural resources. They're kind of making sure that markets stay open is the big focus.
The way that I can kind of hit it home is the agreements that I'm referring to,
yeah,
they're institutionalized within the World Trade Organization.
Right. Okay.
So, I mean, the goal of the World Trade Organization isn't to like protect natural resources and the environment.
Right.
It's to keep free trade and free markets open. And I mean, that's done a lot for people in the world.
Absolutely.
It has.
Right.
But then there's this trade-off. And so how do you navigate that trade-off in the most win-win type of way possible is a wicked problem.
Yeah, there's a wicked problem where there's downsides even to the solution, like you were saying. So I guess in the context, this is something I had never thought of before. Of course, it would be massively important to how we're talking about pathogens moving into new environments is the effect of trade policies. Is there anything, again, we're prefacing this with, this is not the opinion of the U.S. government, or, you know, this is strictly coming from Jeff
yeah,
Williams.
I'm already getting into the red here.
Yeah, well.
I think we're good. We're still good. I'm not saying what should or shouldn't be done.
Okay, well, I was going to say, as Jeff Williams, a citizen, but maybe we can't, like, separate those two. So when we're talking about making sure that this balance doesn't tip too far away from protecting natural resources, what are the most useful tools we can use to do that? Is it just more research so that we can definitively say, hey, we need to adjust this type of trade or keep a certain product out because we know there's a pathogen? Is it strictly more research like that? Or is there something else we can use to make sure that it doesn't go, you know, wildly out of balance and that these agreements can still be used to protect natural resources?
I mean, I think you can do all the research you want. And certainly we need to continue doing research. But there's two things that we can do to make headway on this wicked problem is,
yeah,
A, give more people a seat at the table, because this is a problem that affects everyone, but it requires a lot of cooperation and trust among a lot of countries and people and institutions. And that's the only way you can solve these types of wicked problems, because there's so many stakeholders that have this perception of huge conflicts of interest among them, but really we all want the same thing. So giving more people a seat at the table, building trust, that side of things, that's one. But the other thing is also, you know, taking a more proactive stance with this problem instead of waiting till it's too late. Instead of always, you know, assessing risk based on kind of the economic value of what's at risk, like with laurel wilt, which is well known as a huge threat to the avocado industry in Florida. It, before that was recognized, it basically wiped out an entire species of trees native to the Southeast. But no one cared until it started hitting avocado.
Right.
So these are the types of situations where if we had taken a more proactive approach to that problem, and even before the introduction of that disease, if we had known about it. And so one of the ways that we think we can do that is by monitoring trees that in other countries that are either the same species that we have here or closely related, and knowing the pests and pathogens on those trees.
Mm.
So for example, you might be familiar with emerald ash borer.
Yes.
So for the audience, like, emerald ash borer is this beetle. It's an agrilis beetle. It's not actually related to bark beetles. It's in another group of beetles. And it just kills like all these different species of ash that are native to North America. Pretty much there's no respite. I mean, the ashes are being extirpated from the forests and it's spreading. You know, there were American ash in China that got killed by these beetles before these beetles came to the North America. And it was known a little bit, but there was no kind of, they didn't trigger any sort of like, oh, we better watch out for this. If it comes here, this is what it might do.
It's not threatening the avocado trees yet, so we're good.
Exactly. That too. Yeah. So it's like those,
yeah.
It's like the intrinsic value of the native forest species, and then also trying to take this proactive approach to say, well, what can we find out about before it's here? Because usually, I don't know if I mentioned this, but many times, a large proportion of the time, these things could be new to science sometimes, but they're often not known, at least to Westerners. And so just like knowing about them before they come here could help a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, I love those solutions because we're talking about something really broad and bringing more stakeholders to the table, more people involved in the discussion around novel interactions between pests and pathogens of forests, getting early warning systems. Now, just, I may be wrong on this, is this the Sentinel Tree Program?
So what I was kind of alluding to was the idea of a Sentinel Tree, yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of Sentinel Tree research going back to the 90s and even before. And I mean, one of those things is that plantation forestry often relies on exotic trees,
mm-hmm.
because they don't have pests and pathogens like they have here.
Right.
So they often will grow really well in some of these novel environments until something comes along and...
Until something jumps hosts and then we have that problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And even like going back to some of the literature from when they were first kind of starting this like exotic plantation forestry across the world, which I recently learned a lot of it was funded by the World Bank, which I did not know. It's interesting. But going back to a lot of these reports and things like that, we can kind of learn about some of the pests and pathogens that were encountered early on trying to introduce some of these different species, different countries. So that's also a Sentinel Tree approach. But then you could also go actively plant trees. There's other projects looking at like botanical gardens. You know, there's Sentinel Trees that are in other continents, and then there's Sentinel Trees here too to like detect pests and pathogens here. And so, and I'm not directly involved in all of this.
Right.
But there's a network of, or indirectly even, there's a network of botanical gardens that are all participating in monitoring for pests and pathogens here in the U.S. And then there's also like an international network of botanical gardens. And then one of the things that we're also looking at, and anyone that's interested, I'd love if you reached out, is looking at urban forests, because urban forests are often kind of like ground zero for a lot of these invasive pest pathogen problems.
And is that just because a lot of the times pest pathogens are flowing through kind of human channels, it starts in an urban area?
I think a lot of times they're flowing through channels with a lot of human activity. So,
right, okay.
You know, ports and then just movement within the U.S., like whether it's trade related or just individuals. And then also urban forests have a really big mix of just novel kind of mixes of different hosts. You know, they have a lot of native species. They have a lot of exotic species. So you might have a Norway maple and then a sugar maple, for example, or all of those kind of factors make urban forests, and some of these diseases and problems end up just being problems in urban areas too. And then, yeah, even the heat island effect could be part of it. Like, there's definitely a lot to unpack with that. But because there's all of these urban forest inventories that are becoming available now, we can start to look at that as a potential resource for monitoring for invasives and sentinel trees.
Yeah, and it's just a strategy that, as intuitive and as good an idea as it sounds, I had just not thought of. But of course, you would want to monitor for populations around the world, potential environments where you would get these novel interactions before they're widespread, like the earliest warnings, to try to monitor and see if you can assess and understand it before it is too late. And I love then the point you made before too about moving that needle, we've mentioned a couple times, from just the economic value to the intrinsic value. I mean, right at the start when I asked, you know, why do we think invasives are a problem now? I mean, how do we measure if it's a problem or not? And you said it right on the head, is that idea we're losing diversity and there's an intrinsic value in these species, in this diversity. And if we move, whether that's the regulatory, policymaking, academic, science, needle, whatever those needles are that help us focus in on this problem sooner, if we move that away from the economic, where it's usually focused, to the intrinsic value, I mean, that's a huge step in how we even approach this problem. So I think you laid out some of really the most fundamental, far-reaching strategies that we can do that, again, I didn't immediately think of. And then in this realm of strategies too, I want to mention, is there anything we can do, and maybe this is part of that wicked problem where we don't know what the effects would be, but just in your example with the Geosmitha, where it's competing against other fungal organisms. I mean, are there strategies using biocontrols, like maybe other organisms in forests? Strategies to breed more resilient forests? I mean, what are some of the, are there strategies like that we can implement too to try to make forests better at resisting potentially novel interactions from new pathogens?
So that's a great question. So I wanted to go back just a little bit and just emphasize that invasive species is like it's a fraught term, right?
Yes.
And so I just want to make sure that like anyone that's listening to this podcast knows that I get that there's a lot of controversy around that term. And I hope that I've made the case that we should at least be thinking about, you know, the impacts that some organisms could have ecosystems. But also, I think it's important that we all have some input on whether we want to do something about it, right? I mean, instead of just coming down and saying, well, we're the scientists and this is a problem and you guys should care about it, because that's going to help us with what you're asking is, what can we do? What can people do about this?
Right.
And the first thing we can do is we can empower ourselves to have some stake in in the conversation. So I think just opening up this discussion, being conscientious of the issue, but also, you know, think global, act local.
Yes.
We can all agree on that. I mean, it's not controversial. Whether you're, you know, whether you're in a trade union or you're a local urban farmer or whatever it is you do, we can all agree, like, you know, we want to empower local businesses, local economies, but also like local ecosystems. And there's that. And then also like the people in the places where they live and where they're from, they're the experts on their landscapes. Like, don't let someone in come in and tell you what needs to, you know, what you should be doing to protect your forests. You know what needs to be done. If everyone has a seat at the table in coming up with kind of collective action to solve this social dilemma, then we can empower ourselves. We can have a feeling of self-efficacy because we're the ones that notice the problems, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I know what a sick walnut looks like. I've been looking at walnuts like every day for the last 5 years.
Right.
But like, if you brought someone that's never seen a walnut tree in their life and said, hey, look at that tree, they'd be like, what about it? You know what I mean? Maybe they'd be like, oh yeah, it looks like it's dead. But if it's dying, they might not notice the difference because most trees look kind of like not so happy most of the time. So I guess my point is, you know, what can we do? We really need to bring this forest health issue into not just into a place where it's part of our national dialogue, but also into a place where we are all on the same page, where we agree. Because I think the whole history of invasion biology, the lexicon, like the terms that we use, the framework, you mentioned biological control. I mean, that can be extremely divisive, right?
Sure.
But also it's been very effective as well in certain situations. But it's not as effective, or it hasn't proven. So like biological control of invasive plants with insects has been very successful. Biological control of invasive insects with other insects has also been very successful in many cases. And in many cases, hasn't had, I mean, we all know about, like, when it goes wrong, it makes a lot of news, you know?
Right, right. It's a cautionary tale, yeah.
Like the cane toads in Australia, I don't know if you, there's this film, I don't remember the name of it, but they introduced these toads to control some other biological control that they had introduced to control, like, a weed or something, and now, like, they're completely naturalized in Australia. There's these huge toads that like take over entire roads and like can kill pets.
Oh my
like,
God.
Cause they're like poisonous too. But yeah, the early days of biological control was just a disaster. I mean, we can all agree on that. But the other thing is that like, it's not going to solve the problem alone. It can be part of a integrated suite of tactics. Biological control works a lot better if you also have some resistance in the population, because if there's, and some susceptibility actually, because if there's no like hosts left, they're all dead, then you're just going to have a big crash in the pest population and then a crash in the biological control population. So like they go together really well, but also pathogens haven't really been effectively controlled biologically in most cases. I mean, there's some examples, but it's just not anywhere near like for insects. So it's something to consider. I mean, hopefully that changes, but just to be real about it, what we have, but the most effective solutions come earlier in the process. They come, you know, even stopping things before they even get here in the first place. And we can't do that until we kind of rethink how we value forests and kind of let everyone participate in almost like a democratic process, but not so much democratic as just a collective action process where we agree on something.
It's one of those examples, and the other one that I was just thinking of that's kind of analogous is this recent push by many people, the Fungi Foundation, many people to push adding funga or fungi into that triumvirate, yes, flora, fauna, funga. Absolutely. And so it's one of those things that conceptually you push that into firmly into the conversation, firmly into the discourse. And we don't know exactly what that's going to do, but we know that it'll get everyone thinking about it. And the solution is really going to come once that is at the forefront. So this conversation you're coming on talking about, giving us the scope of the forest health crisis that we're facing. And I love your term novel interactions, because I too have heard that feedback that the term invasive is fraught. And I asked at the beginning, you know, things have been moving around. Why is it suddenly bad? You know, and there can be connotations of certain people bringing something somewhere that, you know, has all kinds of other xenophobic undertones and everything else that we kind of want to distance from. So I love that idea of like being conscious of novel interactions that are possible and pushing that at the forefront of our mind. And then, bringing it to a local level. You know, recently I've moved to a new city in the past 8 months and we started getting really involved in the city council. And, you know, so when people are talking about the planning department, new development projects, you know, let's push forest health to the front of that conversation. How is this going to impact forests? Where, I mean, maybe it's a conversation of where are the resources coming from? And this is a grossly oversimplified, but we're talking about bringing in lumber. You know, where is that coming from? Is there something here we can do? Maybe we set up monitoring around the development in trees to catch if there's something new in that microbiome of the trees around some new development. Again, a simplified example, but
I love the direction you're taking it though. I mean, that's really what I'm talking about with empowerment. And yeah, totally.
Exactly. So the solution is actually kind of more broad, but kind of more approachable in a way. It's like we need to really engage with the issue first, and then we're going to think of creative solutions. So, you know, I was kind of teeing it up for a big, like, tell us the fancy biological control or what we're going to do to stop the next pathogen. You're like, man, I don't have that answer, but I think we can get that answer if we kind of bring more people to the table, bring it to the forefront of the conversation. You know, these are all big factors, and shift that needle. Again, I love shifting that needle to understand there's an intrinsic value here. So we should be concerned about it, whether or not there's an economic impact involved. So, man,
So I can take it a step further. I mean, this is the crazy thing is like, I mean, how much sense does it really make for me to go all over the world to all the different countries and look at U.S. species there? I could just be looking at exotic trees here and telling people to go look at exotic our trees there. Right. So that's where the citizen scientists can really come in, because, you know, now that we have like all these really cool molecular tools that are becoming accessible to just everyday people that are into science, nerds, biohackers, whatever. I mean, yeah, go out and look for diseases on the exotic trees in your neighborhood. Like I want to know what's killing the Norway maple or the Austrian pine, or, you know, if you're on the West Coast, I mean, wow, you guys have all kinds of crazy stuff growing out there. So that was kind of one thing that I'd been trying to get going is, can we proactively like warn our fellow global citizens about what we might have here? You know, it's kind of like if I was, I'm going to make kind of like a off color analogy, but like if I was dating someone, they want to know if I had like COVID or whatever. If I knew that, I would tell them. That would be kind of gross to not tell, like, so if we're going to like engage in global trade, like going to engage in global trade, like, oh, by the way, like I didn't tell you, they're like, we got all these diseases in our trees. Did you know about this? Like, why didn't you tell me, you sleazeball?
Right. Yeah. All of our Norwegian maples just had a problem. Sorry. We just did that trade with your Norway. Hope that doesn't go to your maples. Yeah. I love that idea. How we can, I see what you're saying. The model can be, we can all be early warning systems for other countries or wherever the native range for some tree is, if we notice that tree having problems here. And it gets to the heart of a concept that comes up constantly on the podcast, is the importance of citizen science and raw data collection. I mean, talk about the ability to, and the Clarion call goes out to me too, you know, everybody, like, talk about a project you could set up to use all the fancy, you know, PCR tools and sequencing tools that we're getting more and more access to. Is suddenly you can go out and start just testing trees, see what's in there, see what we can learn, see what you can learn about the biome of, you know, fungal pathogens where you are, and who knows, you know, how that will lead to or what we could organize into some broader movement.
And I would definitely say, like, if you are aware of a forest, like, pest or pathogen problem in your area, reach out to your local urban forestry. But also, you know, if you know some researchers or other people in the mycological community that just, you're like-minded people, like, talk about it with them. Like, and, you know, if you have access to sequence it. I mean, for sure, because that's another thing, is invasive species, they're not really species. Species aren't invasive, it's populations. So, you know, even if it's something that's already known, it could be a new type, could be a new introduction that's more virulent. I mean, you saw that with Dutch elm disease. It, you know, bounced back and forth between Europe and the US a couple of times, hybridized, and then it had a resurgence like 50 years later. The same thing could happen with, you know, some of these other diseases that we've had. And it's just important to just always be on the lookout. And I don't want people to look at exotic trees and not be paying attention to our native species too. I'm just saying, don't just throw them out like as trash, because they could be valuable sources of information for someone in another country.
Yeah, that piece about invasive populations, that changes that conversation again, that they, yeah, these are just populations. Who knows how they've adapted since they got here? They may not be a problem in it. That's huge, man. Well, this is a far-ranging and complex conversation. So I'm really happy that you were able to give us some tools with which to kind of grasp the problem, but also some tools by which, you know, I'm sure people like me are thinking of all these scenarios where you could try to create some early warning detection. I mean, who knows if you're in an urban area where there is a lot of flow of human traffic, if you will. Maybe there's a monitoring program you set up there, because who knows what you'll find. You know, as the great Britt Bunyard said, like, science happens when you look at something nobody's looked at yet. So, you know, who knows what you're going to find?
Yeah, especially if you're planting, you know, if you're involved in these planting programs, like, monitor those plantings, you know?
Oh, that's a good point of, yeah, plant trees save the world, but monitor the ones you plant too.
Yeah, and plant the right plant for the right, you know, environment and all that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we were able to talk about citizen science.
Absolutely. I think that, again, it's a huge theme, and it gives everyone an avenue to take some action if they're interested. And if they are interested in this kind of work, you know, you're someone who we've heard kind of your journey through biology to studying organisms that interested you, until now you're kind of at the center of this conversation. What would be your advice for people that want to pursue work in studying, preserving forest ecosystems? You know, are there some sage words of wisdom that you'd have for people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would just say it's really good to have like a network and mentoring, like, relationships with people. And, you know, whether that's in academia or outside of academia, it doesn't really matter, because, you know, we need to believe in ourselves, but when we have someone else that believes in us, it can make a huge difference. And that goes both ways. I mean, if you're in a position where you can mentor someone and they're seeking that from someone or from you, I mean, invest in that, because, I mean, human relationships are really the only thing that we can take with us. I mean, and I could publish a paper, but once it's published, it's like done. You can take the relationships that you formed in the process with you. And that's what's really going to give you like a feeling like you did something, I think. Is that because you did it with someone else? It wasn't
meaning
just alone.
Yeah. Whew. That was advice everyone could take away from this, I think, in all aspects. But yes, that idea of, you know, be willing to be mentored, and that's something so simple that it's, you know, my wife, well, my wife has a gift for it to, like, oh, why don't you ask someone who's doing what you're interested in and ask them for help? And it's like, well, yeah, but you know, we have so many blocks around that. So that's huge. And then also, if you are in a position of knowledge or understanding on a subject and you know people are interested, you know, being the person that reaches out to kind of lift others up and help them kind of pursue that, like, yeah, fantastic advice on both ends of that relationship. I guess what's next for you then? I mean, we talked about your PhD research. You know, you're coming on having this conversation. So obviously you've got ideas brewing. You know, what do you see as a project or something that you're excited about coming up in the future?
I mean, I'm just excited to learn more about the biodiversity, global biodiversity of forest pathogens, because, you know, I think fungi are really amazing. And I think I kind of emphasize also that, like, plants were my first love too, but like fungi are cryptic, pathogens are cryptic. There's all this diversity of pathogens out there that we could be studying, and some of them are like just incredibly interesting biology, but also, you know, insidious. And so, like, if we really want to respect fungi, like, a whole healthy respect for them is like to respect like their capacity to change landscapes and ecosystems, and that includes like devastate human society. And like,
yeah,
I mean, I care about people. I think we all do, and that's part of the reason people are involved in so many people are so passionate about fungi is because of the communities that form around them. So, you know, plant pathogens have human impacts, and so I think I want to continue to like learn more about what those impacts are, because I think they could be explored a lot more. I mean, not just in forests, just in general, but I also, yeah, I want to learn more about the biogeography of plant pathogens and the biodiversity, global biodiversity of plant pathogens. There's so much there to be learned.
I mean, those are some of the most exciting questions. Yeah. How are these pathogenic fungi moving, or if they start showing up in wildly different places, how did they get there? So, well, there's one thing then for sure, as you continue your journey, you're not going to be bored. There's always going to be tons of questions to keep asking and looking into. Well, where can people find more about you and your work? And this is a question, you know, if you're like, I don't have a website or anything, but just, you know, where could people find either more about yourself and your work, research that's inspired you, you know, anything you want to leave us with for people that want to dig deeper or more, learn more about these topics or your work?
Totally. I mean, there's a couple things. I do have a website. It's like jeffreywilliams@weebly.com. I think it's Jeffrey Williams. Maybe it's Jeffrey M. Williams, actually. And then, you know, do feel free to email me. My email is, so it's spelled GEOFFREY, Jeffrey Williams, FS640, like the number 640, @gmail.com. Or, like I said, you can check out the website if you want to learn a little bit more about the project. That's GEOFFREYMWilliams.weebly.com, I believe. But also, I would imagine that there are some people listening to your podcast that are either, you know, forestry or natural resource professionals, or they may be interested in research or involved in it. And or if you're an amateur or whatever you are, if you have some connection to forestry, like professionally or in other activities, you could join the Society of American Foresters. And actually, there's an international forestry working group that I'm involved in, and we're trying to kind of bring international forestry, kind of give it a little bit more high profile within the society. Because, like I said, forests are an international resource, like a shared resource. But if you're not interested in going that route, just get involved locally. And I don't know, I mean, I like self-promoted like this before, so I wasn't really like, didn't come ready to live. But those are some things you could do, I guess.
Definitely check out the website. It does give some good background. It is jeffreymwilliams.weebly.com. We'll have that in the show notes. Definitely check it out. And yes, I mean, you gave the great advice. Network, network, network. Find people who are doing what you're interested in doing. Learn from them or join and help teach others. So some great things for us to follow up on. And I'll wrap things up then with the three questions that I like to ask all my guests. And I usually get really interesting answers kind of all over the place. And first one, you may have a unique answer for, but that is, what is a fungus or mushroom that you love and why? You can love its destructive power. You can love how it tastes, how it looks. A mushroom or fungus you love and why?
Wow, that's tough. Well, so, I mean, I took this question like very straight as mushroom. And I mean, the first thing that came to mind was Amanita muscaria, because it's just so cool. The fly agaric, like all of the stories behind it. I remember one of my friends was telling me that that's like where Santa Claus came from, because like reindeer would eat it and all that story. And some other people thought it was like the soma of the ancients and all this. But then I was like, well, what's a really cool mushroom though? Cause like, I'm so unenthused when I see Amanita muscaria. I'm like, those are cool. But if you see a really nice, pretty one, it's like exciting. But Cortinarius violaceum, I saw recently, and that was like, it's a mushroom. Like, it's not that weird in shape, but
right.
Man, is it a cool mushroom. I mean, it's like deep, deep purple. We saw a super fresh one, and like the velvet on the cat was just like, oh my god, like what is this? So cool. What a cool mushroom.
I mean, yeah, an absolute stunner. And you know, no surprise, I think both of those mushrooms, but Cortinarius violacea has been a lot of people's like favorite mushroom, or mushroom they want to make sure they mention, for good reason, because it is an absolute stunner. And then, you know, much more broadly, I guess, and you can go any direction you want, but what has this relationship you've developed with fungi given to you? And you kind of hinted at the appreciations of all the aspects of fungal organisms and how you love studying forests. What has the relationship you've developed with fungi given to you?
Wow. You're like, this is opening my mind, like this discussion, because I just realized that like the thing that I always thought was so fascinating about mushrooms is how everything is so interconnected by fungi. It goes back to how we're so interconnected in this world, and our forests are so interconnected by all the mushrooms and fungi, but also pathogens that can help regulate or devastate ecosystems. So, I mean, just that interconnectedness with people, with places.
Yeah, you know, they are in so many ways a talisman of interconnection. So when you learn more and more, it just like heightens your awareness of that in all other aspects. I can totally see that. And then, you know, as we develop a deeper understanding of fungal organisms, again, on both sides of the coin, positive, perceived, negative, you know, devastation they can wreak, everything like that. As we develop those understandings as a collective, as one global family, if you will, how do you hope that changes things for the better moving into the future? You know, and I know that's a massive question. So if it's just something, you know, you hope we learn, or some new technology we develop, how do you, what's your highest aspirations for our collective future with fungi?
I've seen the way it brings people together. I mean, that's the best, like the best part of it. And I think it will continue to do so, because I mean, this issue that we're talking about doesn't have to be divisive. It's something that I think that we can all have a stake in. And even if you're just talking about mushroom hunting, I mean, I've seen the way that you have enthusiasts in mushroom hunting. I mean, shout out to my mom. She's like a certified mushroom harvester in Michigan.
Mrs. Williams.
So, yeah. But I'm just saying, like, everyone can take joy in hunting mushrooms, but then also just in observing how interconnected everything is in this world. And I think we're all acutely aware of that right now, as we've both been feeling more isolated than we ever have before and yet more interconnected at the same time, you know, I think that that's the lesson that we can kind of, we can learn. And I think in the future, it'll only bring us together even more. Because, I mean, think about how, you know, if we really do think global and act local, I mean, there's so many other benefits to that besides just protecting natural resources. So, yeah.
Absolutely. More joy, more interconnectedness, more opening people up to these kind of conversations, this kind of information and understanding. I think those are only going to yield more and more amazing things for us into the future. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show, really outlining a topic for me that I knew was out there but understood very little about, and really expanding, maybe changing the way, reframing how I thought about some of these issues, broadening those perspectives. It was a really, really enlightening conversation, man. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, this has been really, really enjoyable for me. So thanks.